A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You're at a dinner party. Someone says something that lands badly, and you need your face to say nothing at all. That moment, that split-second negotiation between what you feel and what you can afford to show, is what Daniel's asking about this week.
And he's right that it's a negotiation. It's not a switch.
He sent in a whole breakdown of the problem. The core tension is this. Sometimes you're stuck in a situation you can't escape. Displaying your true feelings would make things worse. But the human body is basically a broadcast system for internal states. Microexpressions, vocal tone, word choice, posture, all of it leaks. So his question is, given all those channels, what actually works for short-term concealment, and what are the traps that make it backfire?
And he's careful to say this isn't about becoming a permanent blank slate. He knows long-term suppression is a bad bet. This is tactical, situational, the emotional equivalent of holding your breath for 30 seconds because the alternative is worse.
So today we're going to look at the mechanics of emotional leakage, the techniques that actually work for short-term suppression, and the research on why doing this too often is a bad bet.
Let's start with the channels. What exactly are we fighting against?
Because if you don't know what's leaking, you can't plug the holes.
The first thing to understand is that emotional leakage isn't a bug. It's a feature of how human communication evolved. Our faces, voices, bodies are designed to broadcast internal state. The function is coordination. If I see you're afraid, I know there's a threat. If I see you're angry, I know a boundary was crossed. The whole system evolved to make internal states visible to the group.
Which means trying to shut it off is like trying to stop a sneeze. You can do it, briefly, but the machinery isn't on your side.
And the machinery has multiple independent channels, which is what makes this hard. You can control your face and forget your voice. You can control your words, and your hands give you away. They're semi-autonomous.
Walk me through the channels. Start with the face, since that's what everyone thinks of first.
Microexpressions. These are full-face emotional expressions that last between 1/25th and 1/5th of a second. Ekman's original work identified them as involuntary leakage of genuine emotion before the conscious control systems kick in and substitute a managed expression.
The famous one being the flash of anger that crosses someone's face and is gone before you can even name what you saw.
Pop culture turned this into a lie detection superpower. You see it in every crime procedural, the detective who spots the microexpression and knows the suspect is lying. The reality is messier. A major meta-analysis published in 2024 pooled data across dozens of studies and found that microexpression detection accuracy is modest at best and heavily context-dependent. They're real, they happen, but they're not a reliable deception indicator.
So, what are they actually good for?
Intensity. They tell you someone is feeling something strongly enough that it broke through before they could catch it, but they don't tell you why. Is the person angry because they're guilty, or angry because they're being falsely accused? Same microexpression, opposite meanings.
Which means, from the concealment side, if a microexpression slips out, you've revealed intensity, not necessarily the story behind it.
Right. And the face has another problem, the Duchenne versus non-Duchenne smile. A genuine smile involves both the zygomatic major, which pulls the corners of the mouth up, and the orbicularis oculi, which crinkles the skin around the eyes. The forced smile only activates the mouth, and people are surprisingly good at spotting the difference.
The smile that doesn't reach the eyes.
It's one of the most reliably detected fake expressions. People often default to smiling when they're trying to hide displeasure. It's the go-to mask. But if you only engage the mouth and not the eyes, you look insincere, and that can be worse than showing nothing.
So the forced smile is a trap.
And the alternative, the poker face, has its own problem. Maintaining a deliberately neutral face requires active muscular control, and that effort shows up as tension. A 2019 study on embodied emotion regulation found that suppressing facial expression actually increases physiological arousal. Your heart rate goes up, your skin conductance goes up. The body is still having the emotion, it's just not showing it on the face, and the effort of suppression is itself a source of stress.
So the poker face is physically costly, and it doesn't even look neutral. It looks tense.
Often it looks hostile. People read the tension as anger or disapproval. There's a phenomenon called the illusory face effect, where a neutral expression on someone who's internally agitated gets misread as negative because the observer picks up on the strain without knowing what it is.
Let's move to the voice. What leaks there?
The voice might be the harder channel to control. A 2025 study looked specifically at vocal markers of suppressed emotion. Participants tried to hide anger and sadness while speaking neutral content, and listeners could detect which recordings contained suppressed emotion above chance, even when the actual words gave them nothing.
What were they picking up on?
Pitch shifts, mostly. Suppressed anger tends to raise pitch slightly and increase vocal tension. Suppressed sadness lowers pitch and slows tempo. There's also microtremor, a slight unsteadiness in the voice that the person can't hear themselves but listeners detect unconsciously.
And the words themselves?
Language leakage is a whole field. When people try to conceal negative emotion, they use more fillers. They use more negations, I'm not upset, it's not a problem. And they shift pronouns. Fewer first-person singulars, more second and third person. Instead of, I'm angry, it becomes sometimes situations are frustrating.
Distancing language. The grammar of someone trying to be somewhere else.
They also over-explain. The person who's fine gives you a one-word answer. The person who's suppressing gives you a paragraph about why they're fine with footnotes.
And body language?
Two opposite failure modes. Some people go rigid. The freeze response, hypomobility. They sit very still, hold their posture fixed, and it reads as unnatural. Other people go the other direction, fidgeting, touching their face, playing with objects. Both are leakage. The freeze response is the body's threat detection system activating, and the fidgeting is excess arousal looking for an outlet.
So you're either a statue or a wind-up toy, and neither looks calm.
And here's the thing the 2019 study really nailed. Suppressing the expression doesn't reduce the emotion. It increases the physiological arousal. The emotion is still happening. The body is still reacting. You're just not letting it out through the usual channels. It's like capping a pressure valve. The pressure doesn't go away.
Which brings us to the practical question. Given all that, what actually works?
The research draws a really sharp line between two strategies. One is expressive suppression, clamping down on the outward display after the emotion has already been generated. The other is cognitive reappraisal, which intervenes earlier. You change how you're interpreting the situation, which changes the emotion itself.
So suppression is damage control after the fact. Reappraisal is preventing the damage.
And the difference shows up in every measure. The foundational work is James Gross at Stanford, going back to the late 90s but replicated many times since. Reappraisal reduces both the subjective experience of negative emotion and the physiological arousal. Suppression reduces neither. You still feel bad, your body still reacts, you just look blank while it's happening.
Give me a concrete example of reappraisal in the moment.
Say someone says something insulting at that dinner party. The automatic appraisal is, this person is attacking me, I'm being humiliated. That generates anger, shame, the full stress response. Reappraisal would be reframing it. This person is insecure and this is about them, not me. Or, this is a test of whether I can stay composed, let's see if I can pass it. The situation doesn't change, but the meaning does, and the emotional response shifts accordingly.
That sounds like it requires cognitive resources that might not be available when you're already stressed.
That's exactly the limitation. But there are other techniques that are less cognitively demanding. Attentional deployment is one. You shift your focus to something neutral or positive in the environment instead of the thing that's triggering you.
The classic advice about focusing on a spot on the wall.
Or the pattern of someone's tie, the shape of a window, the texture of the tablecloth. It works because emotion generation depends on what you attend to. If you stop attending to the insult, the emotional response attenuates. It's not as effective as reappraisal for changing the underlying emotion, but it's faster and requires less mental bandwidth.
And there's a physiological technique too, right? The breathing thing.
Controlled breathing, specifically slow exhales. The vagus nerve is the main pathway of the parasympathetic nervous system, the calming branch, and it's wired such that exhaling activates it. A 4-second inhale, 6-second exhale pattern, done discreetly, can dampen the fight-or-flight response within a couple of breath cycles.
Can you do that without looking like you're doing breathing exercises at the dinner table?
If you're already talking or someone else is talking, yes. You time the exhales to coincide with moments when you're not the center of attention. The key is making the exhale longer than the inhale, and doing it slowly enough that your shoulders don't visibly rise and fall.
So those are the techniques that work. What are the things to avoid?
The big one is the clampdown, pure expressive suppression. It backfires in multiple ways. It increases your physiological arousal. It impairs your memory for the conversation because you're using cognitive resources on the suppression instead of on processing what's being said, and it makes you seem less trustworthy to observers.
Wait, less trustworthy?
People can tell something is being hidden, even if they can't identify what. The mismatch between the controlled surface and the leakage underneath creates a sense of inauthenticity. A 2023 study found that people who use suppression as their default emotion regulation strategy report lower relationship satisfaction and higher depressive symptoms, even controlling for baseline negative affect.
So the person who never shows what they're feeling ends up lonelier and sadder, which is exactly what they were probably trying to avoid.
It's a trap that looks like a solution. You suppress to protect relationships, and the suppression damages the relationships.
What are the other mistakes? You mentioned the forced smile.
Over-rehearsing neutral expressions. People who plan their face in advance often end up looking robotic, because real faces are in constant micro-motion. A truly neutral face isn't frozen, it has small fluctuations. The frozen face reads as unnatural immediately.
And the eye contact problem.
Right. People either avoid eye contact, which reads as shifty, or they overcompensate and stare too fixedly, which reads as aggressive. Normal conversation involves eye contact about 60 to 70% of the time with natural breaks. The person who never breaks eye contact is broadcasting effort.
And the voice thing, the monotone.
Monotone vocal control sounds like you're reading a script. Natural speech has prosodic variation, pitch rises and falls, tempo changes. Flattening all of that out is a huge signal that something is being managed. It's the vocal equivalent of the frozen face.
So the pattern here is that overcorrection is as revealing as the original emotion.
It's the uncanny valley of emotional concealment. The closer you get to perfect neutrality, the more the effort itself becomes the tell.
Let's talk about the long-term balance. Daniel was clear that he's asking about short-term tactical use, not a lifestyle.
And that's the right framing. The research on chronic suppression is pretty grim. Cardiovascular strain over time, slower emotional recovery after stressful events, reduced social connection. The 2023 study I mentioned found that habitual suppressors don't just look less expressive, they actually receive less social support because people can't read what they need and so don't offer help.
Which creates a feedback loop. You suppress because you don't trust people to handle your emotions, and the suppression makes people less likely to offer support, which confirms your belief that they don't care.
The long-term play is to use suppression as a tactical tool for specific high-stakes moments, job interviews, difficult family events, professional negotiations, and pair it with later processing. Journaling, talking to a trusted person, deliberate reappraisal after the fact. You're not suppressing forever, you're delaying the expression until it's safe.
The diplomat, who stays composed during the negotiation, and then goes back to the hotel room and calls their spouse to vent.
That's the model. The emotion gets processed, just not in the room where it'd be costly.
There's something I want to pull on from earlier. You said reappraisal requires cognitive resources that might not be available under stress. That seems like the central practical problem. The technique that works best is the one you're least able to deploy when you actually need it.
It's the paradox at the heart of this whole field. Under high stress, the prefrontal cortex, which is where reappraisal lives, gets partially taken offline by the amygdala's threat response. You're literally less capable of the kind of flexible thinking that reappraisal requires.
So what do? You can't reappraise, and suppression makes it worse.
This is where the breathing technique and attentional deployment become the bridge. They don't require prefrontal heavy lifting. You can do them even when you're flooded, and what they do is buy you time. A few breath cycles dampen the sympathetic activation enough that the prefrontal cortex comes back online, and then you can reappraise.
So the sequence is, breathe first, think second.
Breathe first, shift attention second, reappraise third. It's a ladder out of the hole, and you climb it one rung at a time.
There's another angle I want to explore. The social cost of being good at this. If you become skilled at concealing your emotions, do people trust you less even when you're being sincere?
There's some evidence for that. People who are perceived as emotionally controlled are often rated as less warm, less authentic, even when they're not concealing anything. The skill itself becomes a reputational liability. It's the politician problem. You're so good at managing your face that nobody believes any of your faces.
Which suggests the optimal strategy isn't to be unreadable. It's to be readable in the right ways, at the right times.
That's exactly what the research on emotional intelligence points toward. The goal isn't suppression, it's regulation. You're not trying to eliminate the signal, you're trying to modulate it. Show enough to be human, not enough to be destructive.
I'm thinking about a specific scenario. A witness in a courtroom or a deposition. Someone who needs to appear credible while under enormous pressure. What does the research say about the difference between someone who suppresses and someone who reappraises in that context?
It's a stark difference. The suppressor looks shifty. They have the frozen face, the vocal tension, the overcontrolled body language, and observers read that as deception even when the person is telling the truth. The reappraiser looks calm and credible because they actually are calmer. Their body language is more natural, their voice is more relaxed, their face moves normally.
So the technique that feels like the safe choice, clamping down, is the one that makes you look guilty.
And the technique that feels risky, letting yourself feel the emotion but reframing it, is the one that makes you look innocent. It's completely counterintuitive.
What about the person who's not trying to hide guilt but suffering? Someone at a funeral or a hospital who needs to hold it together for other people?
That's a different category of concealment, and it's actually the one where expressive suppression is most commonly used and most costly. Grief suppression in particular. The body still grieves. The tears you don't cry show up as muscle tension, headaches, fatigue. And the social cost is that other people don't know you need support, because you look fine.
So the advice there would be what? Let yourself cry at the funeral?
In most contexts, yes. Funerals are one of the few places where emotional display isn't just permitted, but expected. The display rules actually flip. Crying is normative. Stoicism is the deviation. But if you need to hold it together, say you're giving the eulogy, the breathing technique is probably the best tool. Short bursts of control, not all-day suppression.
I want to circle back to something Daniel mentioned about words being telling. You talked about distancing language and over-explaining. Are there specific verbal tells that are especially hard to control?
The pronoun shift is the one that's hardest to catch in yourself, moving from I to you or we or it. I'm upset becomes it's upsetting. You don't even notice you're doing it, but listeners pick up on the evasion. The other one is the hesitation pause. When someone asks you a direct question about your emotional state and you pause before answering, that pause is a leakage cue. Even a half-second delay in saying I'm fine broadcasts that you're not fine.
Because a fine person doesn't need to check.
They don't need to run the internal audit. The answer is immediately available. The delay is the audit happening.
So, if you need to conceal, you have to have your answer preloaded. No hesitation.
Which is itself a cognitive load. You're maintaining a prepared script while also participating in a conversation. It's exhausting, and it's one of the reasons suppression impairs memory for the interaction. You're running two tracks, and the conversation track gets shorted.
Let's step back and talk about display rules, since you mentioned them. The social norms that govern when and how we show emotion.
Display rules are the reason this whole topic is so context-dependent. Every culture, every subculture, every family has rules about what emotions can be shown, by whom, in what settings. In some contexts, anger from a high-status person is permitted or even expected. In others, any anger is a violation. Sadness might be acceptable for women, but not for men. Fear might be acceptable for children, but not for adults.
And the rules are usually unspoken. You absorb them by watching what happens to people who break them.
And a lot of the stress around emotional concealment comes from navigating situations where the display rules are ambiguous or in conflict. You're at a work event that's also social, or you're with in-laws whose family norms you don't fully know. You're trying to follow rules you haven't been taught.
Which is where the default to suppression comes from. When you don't know the rules, you go blank.
It's the safest short-term strategy in an unfamiliar environment. The problem is when the unfamiliar environment becomes familiar and you never update the strategy.
I want to ask about one more specific context. Online communication, video calls. Does the same leakage happen through a screen?
Some of it, yes. Micro expressions are still visible on video, though compressed. Vocal tone comes through clearly. Body language is limited to what the camera shows, but postural rigidity and fidgeting are still visible in the frame. And there's a new leakage channel, gaze behavior. On a video call, where you're looking is highly visible. Someone who's stressed looks away from the camera more often, or stares too fixedly at their own face in the self-view.
The self-view is a whole additional problem. You're watching yourself perform composure, which makes you more self-conscious, which makes you less composed.
It's a feedback loop of awkwardness. The advice from performance psychology is to hide the self-view if you can. Stop watching yourself. It reduces the cognitive load and lets you focus on the interaction instead of on your own face.
That's actually a very practical, immediately actionable piece of advice. Hide the self-view.
It's the digital equivalent of not looking in a mirror while you're trying to have a conversation.
We've covered the channels, the techniques that work, the techniques that backfire, and the long-term costs. What's the single most important distinction for someone to walk away with?
The distinction between suppression and reappraisal. Everything flows from that. Suppression is trying to not show what you feel. Reappraisal is changing what you feel by changing what you think the situation means. One is a lid on a boiling pot. The other is turning down the heat.
The lid strategy has its place. Short term, high stakes, no other option. But you have to know that's what you're doing, and you have to process it later.
Right. The lid isn't a storage solution, it's a delay tactic.
Hilbert, you've been quiet.
I know that look.
The prop.
Say more.
Nobody talks about the prop. Best short-term concealment I ever saw wasn't a technique. It was a coffee cup. Or a notepad. Something to look at that gives your face a reason to be neutral. I dealt poker in Reno for 6 years. You learn to read the tell that isn't a tell, the guy working too hard to look calm. But you also learn to manage your own face when a player is being a nightmare and you can't react. You don't suppress. You look at the chip rack. You're not hiding. You're busy. Busy looks honest.
That's attentional deployment with a social alibi.
It's better than attentional deployment. When you're just focusing on a spot on the wall, people wonder what you're staring at. When you're looking at a coffee cup, you're just a person with a coffee cup. The object gives your face a job.
The prop solves the frozen face problem by giving your neutral expression a reason to exist.
Dealers do it with the chip rack, the shoe, the layout. You're always looking at something, always doing something with your hands. Nobody reads your face because your face is occupied. I had a floor supervisor who could stand next to a player screaming at him and look completely unbothered. He wasn't reappraising, he was counting the chips in the tray.
Counting the chips is a form of attentional deployment that also produces a socially legible activity. You're not checked out, you're working.
It doesn't require the cognitive load of reappraisal. You don't have to reframe anything, you just count, or stir the coffee, or take a note. The motion is the mask.
That's a useful addition to the framework. The prop is a bridge between pure suppression and full reappraisal. It doesn't change the emotion, but it channels the leakage into something that reads as normal.
It also explains why some people instinctively reach for their phone or their drink in tense moments. They're not avoiding, they're self-regulating with available objects.
Phone's a bad prop. Phone reads as checked out. Coffee cup, notepad, something related to the room you're in. The prop has to belong there.
Otherwise, it's just a different kind of tell.
The guy who suddenly needs to check his phone the moment the conversation gets hard. Everyone knows what that is.
The prop rule is, it has to be something you'd be holding or looking at anyway.
Or something you can pick up before the hard moment starts. You don't grab the coffee cup when the insult lands. You already have it. You're not reacting. You're just continuing to hold the cup you were already holding.
Pre-positioned props.
I had a cup of coffee at that table for 6 years. Never drank it.
Wait, you just held it?
Cold coffee's still a prop.
Maybe the prop is the technique. But that still leaves the bigger question. If suppression is so costly and reappraisal is so effective, why do we default to suppression in the moment?
Reappraisal requires cognitive resources that stress takes offline. Suppression is the fallback because it's simpler. It's just inhibition. One command, don't show it. Reappraisal requires generating alternative interpretations, which is creative work, and creativity is one of the first things to go under threat.
we default to the worst strategy, because it's the only one we can access when we're flooded.
Which is why the breathing and the prop are so useful. They don't require the creative work, they just dampen the arousal enough that the creative work becomes possible again.
The other thing I keep thinking about is where this is all heading. AI emotion detection is getting more sophisticated. Voice analysis, facial coding in interviews, sentiment analysis on text. The arms race between concealment and detection is going to intensify.
It's already happening. There are companies selling emotion, AI for job interviews, for call centers, for border security. The premise is that the algorithm can spot microexpressions and vocal tells that human interviewers miss. And the accuracy claims are, let's say, ahead of the evidence.
But even if the accuracy is modest, the fact that the technology exists changes the stakes. You're not just managing your face for the person in front of you. You're managing it for a system that's recording and analyzing at a frame rate no human can match.
That raises hard ethical questions. If the technology becomes reliable, do we have a right to emotional privacy? Can an employer require you to sit for an emotion detection interview? Can a border agent deny entry because an algorithm says your microexpressions indicate deception?
The legal framework for that doesn't exist yet. We're building the detection technology without having decided whether detection is something we want.
From the concealment side, it means the techniques we've been discussing might become more important, not less. Not because people want to deceive, but because they want to maintain some control over what they reveal and to whom.
The goal isn't to become unreadable. It's to have the choice of what to show and when.
That's the whole thing. Emotional autonomy. The ability to decide, in a given moment, whether this person or this system gets access to what I'm actually feeling. Suppression isn't the enemy. Involuntary suppression is the enemy. Suppression you didn't choose. Suppression that's become a habit you can't break.
The techniques we've talked about, reappraisal, attentional deployment, the breathing, the prop, those aren't tools for hiding. They're tools for choosing. You're not building a wall. You're installing a door.
A door you can open or close depending on who's on the other side.
The cutting room floor detail I keep coming back to is from that 2025 vocal study. Listeners could detect suppressed emotion in voices, even when the words were masked, filtered so you could only hear prosody. That means the voice is leaking on a channel that's completely independent of language. You can choose every word perfectly and still give yourself away through the music of the speech.
It's humbling. We think of communication as primarily verbal, but the emotional signal is riding on a carrier wave that predates language. You can't talk your way out of it.
Which brings us back to where we started. The body is a broadcast system. You can modulate the signal, but you can't shut it off. And maybe you shouldn't want to.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us honest and for the cold coffee strategy.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen, it helps. Or send us your own weird prompt at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.